Welcome to Between the Before and After, a podcast about the stories that shape us. I'm your host, Coach John McLernan, and each episode I bring you an inspiring guest with a moving story that shines a light on the power of the human spirit. Before we dive in, I want to let you know about two very important things. Number one, the stories shared here are often gritty, raw, and vulnerable, and very likely will include speaking about sensitive topics suited for a mature audience. Number two, this podcast is also broadcast live on YouTube, Twitch, Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook. So on whatever platform you follow myself or Freedom Nutrition Coaching, you have the opportunity to participate in this discussion during the live stream. And we encourage your participation both by commenting and asking questions. And so this podcast is about exploring the stories that take place between the before and after photos, not just in the realm of weight loss, but in all areas of life. So let's dive in. All right, tonight we're chatting with Kirby. And Kirby, where are you coming at us from?
Hey, John, thanks for having me. I am coming out of Kansas City, Kansas, or Kansas City, Missouri, whichever one you want to say.
It's
Kansas City metro region. Yeah, it's like
split down over state lines, yeah.
Yeah, so it's right in the middle of there, the Kansas-Missouri border, but there's a river that separates the two. So some people say Kansas City, Kansas. Some say Kansas City, Missouri.
Is there any kind of rivalry between like Missouri and Kansas State in that regard? Like, you know, the city belongs to us? Yeah, or?
You know, not really. I would say, you know, the difference that I've seen, at least my perspective is that the Missouri side is more of a business district.
Okay.
It's where downtown's at. That's where the West Bottom's at. The railroad, you know, a lot of that stuff. And then, you know, on the western side, which is the Kansas side, there's more of the entertainment piece, the casinos, the racetracks, shopping. So it's a little bit different districts. I would say if there's any rivalries, it's the counties. The counties like to be a little Johnson County versus Wyandotte County or, you know, this
okay,
and that.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It's little local rivalries. But other than that, I mean, the big rivalry would be Missouri State. Tigers for, okay. or you know, I'm sorry, not Missouri State, University of Missouri Tigers, and then the KU Jayhawks. So,
okay, yeah. I mean, university or varsity sports down there in the U.S. are quite a big deal. So,
yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So, what are you up to these days? Before we dive into your story, I like to learn a little bit about what you're doing right now.
Yeah, so actually, it's quite interesting. I'm kind of going through a little bit of a transition phase right now, as far as, you know, what I'm doing. I'm actually coming out of an internship where I worked with a company called Catalyzer for the last 3 months. I took an opportunity to work for a coaching and training company, small business. Recently went out and worked with the Sheriff's Department and stuff like that, you know, and teaching them leadership foundations. And now, you know, as I exit this, I'm going into a something that's very purposeful for me, which kind of relates to my story. Program called Fathers in the Field. It's a national ministry. And basically what they do is so that would be a regional field missionary where I work with in a few different states and go in and help work with leadership teams, pastors, and other members of the community on building programs for fatherless boys through their curriculum that they have devised to kind of help with that deep wound that these boys have from the abandonment of their earthly fathers, you know, and point them towards their heavenly father. So, which is kind of really interesting because I grew up fatherless. So,
yes,
my purpose is finally becoming realized after 26 and a half years in the military. So,
right. You've taken your pain and turned it into purpose, which I think is something quite remarkable. It's really interesting when the door opens to that. So, we're definitely gonna dive into your story, but I like to pull a card out of my my deck of random cards here. And I think this one actually really fits, and it is: what were you most afraid of as a child?
Oh wow! Probably the thing that I was most afraid of as a child. That's actually a really good story. Not succeeding. I would say that was probably the one, you know, most of us that grew up without a father, I would tell you, you were always competing against the man on our left or right or the boy on your left or right, depending on what stage of life you're in. And, you feel like you have to prove yourself to have value in the world and to have worth.
Yeah.
And so me not succeeding, probably that was a good portion of it. But the other part was that I had this grandfather, that showed up in my life very early. And then we can get into that story as well, but he showed up in my life and he had been there, you know, every week he checked in on me, made sure I was okay, did a lot of things that not having a father, he did for me. And so as I grew up, I never wanted to disappoint him and I wanted to be successful. And, you know, people are like, who's your hero? Superman, Batman, Aquaman, whatever. I was like, my grandfather was my hero. And that was the guy that if there was any person in the world I wanted to make proud, that was the guy. And I was always afraid of disappointing him. Even when I did disappoint him, he'd give me that look and it was just a crushing blow. So he didn't have to say a word, didn't spank my butt or anything. He was just like, I heard what you did. And I'm disappointed. And I'm just like, oh, it was just crushing for me.
Yeah. You know, it's quite remarkable when we have a figure like that, in our lives. Well, I guess I'm a little bit curious, you know, because if that's a fear, it's like, what, you know, usually when we have a fear, there's a fear of a certain consequence or like something is going to happen if this takes place, you know, what was that fear for you? Like, how did it sort of show up?
Well, if there is a fear, it's always the fear of never being good enough, right? Never having what it takes. And that was where I kind of go back to the worth and value. How that showed up was in my aggressiveness and my very assertiveness and my desire to, well, I shouldn't say desire, but need to overcome challenges and obstacles that were in my way. If I felt like I was being challenged, I would pursue that challenge relentlessly. Until, you know, if it boiled down to my knuckles being bloody, I would not quit because I was not going to be that guy. I was not going to be a quitter and I was not going to be defeated. And I wasn't going to let anybody else look down upon me either because I was a survivor. And I had to survive because I didn't have two parents in the home and growing up in a trailer park, low income housing. You know, that's rough for a kid. And you're going to have to roll up your sleeves sometimes and you have to get some things done. And so I pretty much, you know, probably about the age of 12, 13, 14, I started kind of figuring the world out on my own and exploring that. And older boys were raising me and, you know, I was looking up to them and figuring out, you know, what I had to do to survive. You know, my mother had smaller children, so her focus was there while I had to kind of figure out, you know, how am I going to get through the, you know, what's next for me? Like, how am I going to survive? You know, where is my, you know, and I wouldn't say where my next meal is going to come from because she provided for us, but you know, what's the turn of the corner? Like, what am I going to make of myself? So, I didn't really have all that mentoring. I kind of had to stumble across all that, figure it out.
Yeah. And so, are you the oldest of your mother's children?
Yeah, I'm the oldest of four. I have many more brothers, stepbrothers and siblings. I had three stepfathers growing up. So it's kind of a rough home, you know, in and out of different places all the time. I have three half brothers, sisters, and probably about four or five stepbrothers, sisters. So,
okay. So a lot of people that in a sense are family to you. But you're the oldest out of all of those.
Yes. Yep.
Yeah. Okay. And so, you know, so fatherless is a big part of the picture. Was your father ever in the picture or?
No, he was never in the picture. So, you know, what happened, I could kind of tell you the story a little bit. You know, my mother grew up in a pretty decent home, you know, lived up in Peoria, Illinois. Her dad had gotten out of the Navy, you know, had some cash in his pocket, doing pretty well. It was the 50s, you know, 60s, and lost his job. And, you know, at a distillery of all places. And so had to move back home to a small town of about 800 people. Back then it was about 2000. Today it's probably like 400 to 800 now, but, you know, the coal mines were gone. Most of the opportunities in that town were gone. Moved back in with his family, you know, small home. He had seven kids that he was trying to raise and, you know, was driving to St. Louis, which was, you know, 2 hours away. Every day working, you know, 12-hour shifts and just was gone, you know, 6-7 days a week working, you know, and the family felt under some hard times, you know, and, you know, that struck her really hard. And she began to rebel and, you know, walk on that side of the tracks for a while. And, one night after she graduated high school, she went to a party and she was involved in a drug and alcohol induced sexual assault. And I was conceived of that. And I don't know who my father is. My mother doesn't know who my father is. They have this thing in the sexual assault arena, which I have excuse me, I have some experience in that area, having worked as a sexual assault coordinator for the Army, and an instructor for the Army in this category. But they call it blacked out, passed out, where you can't remember what happened to you because of, you know, the drugs and alcohol. You know, it's a sexual assault. And when someone can't consent or, you know, agree to what's about to happen, it's wrong. And so that would happen. And she went like 3 months without telling nobody. She woke up the next morning, left the place, you know, realizes what happened. Didn't tell nobody, kept the secret to herself. And from there, what happened was, is that she finally had to tell him, right? Because she knew that she was pregnant. She like,
yeah,
you know, right? And so she went in and she confirmed the test and she told her parents that she was pregnant. And she let them believe what they wanted, right? You can imagine when people, you don't tell them everything, they begin to fill in the gaps. They just know you're pregnant and the rest of it was history. So there were some unpleasant conversations. You know, she wasn't, you know, the saint of the family. And so she had it pretty rough. Her parents didn't talk to her the remainder of the pregnancy. And that's where my grandfather kind of comes into play, is because, you know, she was, you know, treated with silence. And eventually, the day I was born, my grandmother drove my mother, you know, remember, this is 40 some years ago. So she had to drive her 45 minutes to the hospital. There wasn't a hospital in every town. So,
right.
You know, that takes a while to get there in the early spring of April. But so she drove her to the hospital and didn't even get out of the car. Just said, didn't even open the door. Just said, okay, here you go. She got out, walked in the emergency room, nurse helped her out. And then my grandfather ended up, once my grandmother arrived back home, got in the car and drove back to the hospital and sat out at the waiting room right outside until I was born. And then when I was born, went in, and basically that was it. I mean, he was a huge part of my life after that, ever since then. And in that moment, he forgave my mother for whatever happened. He never knew. She never even told me until after he was passed. And so he never knew what had really happened to his daughter and the circumstances around any of that. But I'm sure that, you know, he would have still have forgiven her no matter what, because he knew that boy, you know, needed a father or a father figure in his life. And to be honest with you, he lost his dad when he was 9 years old. So to natural causes. So you can kind of see, you know, this fatherlessness start to, or, you know, generation after generation after generation. So it does have a huge impact on boys in America today.
You know, and you hear a story like that. And of course, we're hearing it in hindsight in the 21st century, you know, compared to back then. And, you know, my heart just like aches hearing that, like hearing all of it, really. Like, I just think about your mom and like what she would have went through and what she would have had to carry with her as a kind of as a secret, and the shame and the guilt and all of these things. There was nothing to be forgiven, nothing to really, I think, for her to be forgiven of, you know, in a sense. But I guess given the social circumstances of the time, like, she didn't feel that it was her place to express that, I guess.
Well, it's a different time frame. I mean, you know, having had taught in the United States Army's, you know, Sexual Harassment Assault Response and Prevention Academy, one of the modules that we teach is about history of victim advocacy. And the year that I was born, there was only 3 rape crisis centers in the United States: St. Louis, D.C., and San Francisco. That was it.
Wow.
And so when you think about it, we have come so far from there. So the support, the resources, the community, it just wasn't there back then. That's why, you know, I look at the, you know, what happened and I'm like, man, we have come so far since then, you know, and we have so much further to go still. But, you know, I'm grateful that, you know, my mother made the decisions that she made, you know, and she told me, she's like, you're a blessing. You probably saved my life, you know? And so that feels good. Right. And actually we just had that conversation the other day and she repeated that to me. So, so it's good to feel that way. So.
Yeah. To feel that out of like horrific and traumatic and difficult circumstances, that there's a blessing that came from that, you know, I'm sure, you know, especially now you look back, and I'm sure you do everything you can for her as well, knowing that, you know, she did the best she could in incredibly difficult circumstances.
Yeah.
So you grew up kind of with a sense of like you said, worthlessness and needing to prove yourself relentlessly. Yeah. Did that lead to you finding yourself into trouble or into conflict or things like that?
Yeah, for sure, all the time. I was probably the center of conflict, or I created the conflict. You know, a lot of boys do this, you know, out of despair. You know, they don't have a father. They have to prove themselves. They're lost. They're lonely. They're mad. They're angry. They have this deep, you know, anger wound in their soul. And so, yeah, I would, you know, one little thing would happen and I'm like, okay, let's fight, you know, you know, I'm going to bloody you up, buddy. You know, you're not going to, you know, and it was probably the slightest thing. But yeah, there was always conflict. You know, I had a couple cousins and an uncle that were about 2 years older than me. And so they were kind of like my bodyguards and they protected me, you know? And so we were real close, young. And so I would pick fights. And then when people weren't around, you know, when they were around, people would leave me alone because there was more of them. And I remember one day running, you know, back to the school after recess and trying to get back in the building. And well, it caught up to me because one of those kids ran up behind me and smashed my head off the window as I was trying to get into the building. And, you know, that was a lesson, right? You know, be careful who you pick on and don't be picking fights, just be picking fights or be picking at people. And so, you know, you start to slowly figure out, okay, like this is not the right behavior. But you know, that's kind of where that, you know, you have those figures in your life that kind of shift you around a little bit and say, okay, this isn't going to work. And those are those life lessons you begin to learn. And sometimes they're the hard lessons. So,
yeah, you came out of it all right. You know, I was going to wonder about this. If ever you encountered people later in life that maybe you would have had a scrap with, you know, back in the day.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, there's people I've worked with in most organizations and I'm just like, you know, they get me to a point, right? You know, and this is something most of us have to work on anyway, is where I'm red in the face, you know, I feel the frustration, I feel my blood boiling and I just want to fight them, right? And I'm like, you know what? Someone just needs to, you know, beat on you. And I'm like, nope, that's not how we do this today. You know, and it's okay, you know, but you learn to control the rage, right? You learn to control the anger. You take the emotions that we're experiencing, you begin to learn to process those. That's something that, you know, boys without fathers don't know how to do. They don't have that father to pull them aside and say, hey man, like, look, I get it. You're upset. You punched the kid in the face, you know, cause he took your truck, you know, not okay. You know? You know, but we begin to learn to process those emotions a little bit. We brought and take those emotions and do something productive with them. Right. You know, and that is, you know, if anybody knows anything about the human brain, right. Those the first thing that the sensors go to is the, you know, that the part of your brain that controls the emotions, that fight or flee. So you're making an instantaneous decision on what you're going to do. Mm-hmm. And then the rest of those signals travel to the prefrontal cortex. Which you got that more of that executive decision making, like, let's think about that before I do that, you know? And so, yeah. So sometimes our first, you know, especially someone who's experienced trauma, their first reaction is to fight, flight, or freeze. And that's what happens to a lot of us, you know? That's where we're programmed to respond in a certain way. And so you just have to learn how to handle that and deal with it.
I've heard it said that emotions are an action blueprint. And I thought that's a really interesting way to look at it, you know, because there are times when we need to act without executive function. You know, when it's a life and death situation, there isn't time to stop and smell, you know, smell the breeze and sort of look around and you know, get a piece of paper and a pen out and chart a course. Like there isn't time for that. So you have to act right away. But sometimes, could we say those action blueprints maybe get laid down in get wired in like in an improper way. And as a result leads to you taking actions that are maybe regretful down the road, you know?
Yeah. You know, I mean, you know, one of the places where those reactions are positive or, you know, I mean, not necessarily positive, but, you know, a good exercise or practice of them would be if I was in combat in Iraq, you know, I'm not going to stop and like, let me think about that for a minute. No, get down now. You know, it's let's go, you know, get in the truck. Let's go now. We're out of here. You know, it's just, you're not going, you know, those things, you know, they're, and some of those things are trained in you, right? You know, those are developed. Those the repetition, you know, and that's one of the things I loved about the military was the discipline, right? You know, the repetition, the muscle movement, or muscle memory, where you just went over and over and over again until it just became natural.
Yeah. Did you join the military right out of high school?
Yeah, as you know, I was actually joined when I was about 17 years old. I kind of knew from an early age. You know, I think it was about 12 or 14 years old when my grandparents started talking to me about that. And this is where my grandfather and my grandmother, was kind of influencing me at this time. And they knew I was involved in some drugs and alcohol. I was smoking. I was doing all kinds of stupid stuff. I was hanging around the wrong people and involved with the wrong crowds. And that's because I just didn't have a father. And to kind of steer me in the right direction. And so I was doing that. And they said, hey, look, if you don't go in the military, there's probably nothing here for you. And my grandfather told me, he's like, the only thing I regretted after leaving the Navy after 4 years was, not wanting to get off that ship, I should say. And the reason why that was is he just wanted off the command ship. He was tired of all the ceremonies, the parades, all the foreign dignitaries coming on the ship, and all these pompous circumstances, and he's like, I just got tired of it. He's like, I told him I should put me on any fleet in the ship or any ship on the fleet. And they wouldn't do it. And they said, well, you either stay on the command ship or you get out. And he's like, fine, I'll get out. And that's when he went and met my grandmother and stuff. But he said, I regretted kind of making that decision. Not that I regret meeting your grandmother and having this family, but he's like, it was kind of a silly reason to get out, He goes, I love the Navy. I love the camaraderie. I loved everything about the culture in the military. I have a lot of respect for it. He just said, I was a young man and I just made a dumb decision. I thought about that, and I thought about all the things that he said. And look, in my town where I was growing up, there was a glass factory and a brake factory, and both of them were shutting down. That's about 800 jobs in a town of 7,000 people. And the only thing that was left there was a prison. And either you're on the inside or you're watching through the window. So I didn't want to do that. So I had applied to the prison, but I was like, you know what? This isn't for me. I'm out of here. And I went and joined the military to get away. And I ended up staying in the Midwest my entire career. So all of it, but about 8 years, I stayed in the Midwest. So whether it be Indiana, Kansas, Missouri, I was never far from home. So my idea of leaving from home and traveling never really transpired.
So you joined the military. What trade or what because you sort of explained what you did in the military, but I'm not sure. Did you start out in that role or what role?
I didn't. Yeah, no, it was kind of interesting. I always tell this story when I talk to my coaching clients because I work with quite a few folks that are in the service, and I tell them, about when I initially joined, and I wanted to join the infantry, and I wanted to shoot bad guys in the face, right? That fit me really well, and go out and take my frustrations out on the enemy, and it didn't work out that way. I got to the what they call the military entrance processing station. And I did the eye exam and I was colorblind. And they said, well, you can't do that job because you're colorblind. And did you know that? And I'm like, well, my great grandfather was colorblind. So I said, I don't know. He was in the infantry. I thought I could be in, but that was World War II. So a little different back then. And so they said, well, we'll give you three options. They said legal, finance, or HR. And I said, I don't want to be messing with nobody's money because I don't want to get in no more fights. I don't want to put anybody in jail. I've already been in enough trouble with the law. So, and then the third one was HR, and I was like, well, how long is that school? And they said 5 weeks. It means 5 weeks. I still got half my summer left. I come back and drink with my buddies. And that's the decision I made. Very shallow decision, but I was like, I'm just going to be an HR guy. And I just wanted in. I just wanted out of the community. And that's what happened. It was a great opportunity. I got to do a lot of fun stuff. I worked for the Inspector General. I got to do some postal operations. I did a lot of stuff with HR, met a lot of great people, a lot of great leaders, learned a lot about how to treat people, how to do customer service, how to follow up, and building relationships.
Yeah. I wonder if the military kind of played a bit of a father like role with some discipline and some structure and sort of filled that spot that you didn't have in your life.
Yeah, I would say, the first guy I ever met when I went on in, well, one of them, his, the first guy, well, my first boss was named Harlan Evans. He was an old Vietnam vet, got out for a while and then came back. And so he was a pretty good mentor in the military, teaching me my job, giving me opportunities. And then I left the National Guard and I went on active duty in the Army full time when I turned 18. And, when I got to Fort Riley, Kansas, I met this guy named Johnny J. Eaves. And I was like, oh, boy, here we go. I took one look at him and sized him up, and he was sizing me up, and I thought we were in for it. And but I will tell you, that was probably the greatest mentor I've had in my entire life. He saw something in me that I didn't see in myself, and he showed that to me. I had a good work ethic already because I grew up on a farm. I did a lot of farming work when I was in high school and junior high. And, you know, I just put my head down. I worked hard. I kept my mouth shut. I just did my job. I went home. You know, eventually we started having conversations. But, you know, he took me to buy my first car. We went fishing and catfishing together. We had some pretty interesting conversations. He shared some personal things with me. I shared some personal things with him. He took me to watch his jazz band play. You know, and there was just some stuff like that. And we stayed in contact with each other. And I had a lot of loyalty built up to him. Because the next guy that came in to replace him, I couldn't stand the guy. I wanted to fight him too. Because he wanted to change everything about what Johnny did in our, organization.
Isn't that what happens like in the military and bureaucracy? It's like, hey, now that I'm here, I got to make my mark, you know?
Yeah. I'm going to change everything. And I'm like, you're not changing nothing. Like, this works, you know? And so I thought, for me, it felt like he was trying to erase him. And see, as a guy trying to erase someone that I looked up to and I valued, you know, I'd already been abandoned 4 times by stepfathers and other men in my life. And so, like, when you're trying to erase something that was good for me, now we're fighting again. And I ended up looking the guy across the, you know, we were sitting at a table and he was giving me some counseling because I was misbehaving, showing up late for work, just really didn't want to be there anymore. And I told myself, look, you can kick me out of the Army if you want. I don't care. And so the second mentor figure in my life, Ronald Forge, came along and he said, you know, I knew you before this other guy came along. He goes, I knew you, how you acted, how you behaved. I know your character. He's like, do me a favor. He's like, if I can get the recruiter or the retention guy to give you any assignment or any job that you want in the Army, you know, not job, but assignment, what would that be? And if I can get that for you, would you stay in for 4 more years and, you know, just give it another shot and get to see another side of the Army? And so I said, yeah, I'll do that. And I thought I was going to be a smart guy, right? Because I, you know, one of my grandmothers, we always grew up watching the History Channel. And we would always talk about going to Egypt and seeing the pyramids and stuff. And I said, well, if you can give me a job to Egypt, I'll go. Well, guess what? The Army has a unit in the Sinai Peninsula in Egypt. I had no idea. And so I got the job and I was like, well, I'm a man of my word. You know, you wrote me into that one. And so I ended up re-enlisting and stayed for 4 more years. And then it turned into 26. So it worked out well.
So you ended up getting deployed to Egypt.
Yeah. So I spent a year in Egypt. So. In the Sinai Peninsula, working with the multinational force observers. So
how was that? Did you enjoy that?
I did a lot.
I imagine you would have had some like ideas around what it was. You're like, okay, fine. You gave me that thing that I said that I wanted. So now I'm going to go there. And then you get there and I'm always interested to see if it like meets expectations, you know?
Well, it was kind of a culture shock a little bit. I've never been out of the United States, let alone Illinois or Kansas. I mean, you know, you're thinking farm country agriculture, you know? So it's kind of a culture shock. Flying into Cairo. But you know, I get there, you know, you get on like a 6 or 7 hour bus ride, to the Sinai Peninsula. To where the camp was at. It's a 5 mile square camp. All there is a dining facility, a movie theater, and a library to rent books. And so I got a lot of education while I was there because they would fly people in and do classes and stuff like that. But that's where I met a gentleman. Last name was Tony Bond Sr. is his last name. He had a conversation with me about my career, and that's when the career development conversation. So another man that entered my life and just started to start to guide me along the way. And, why aren't you taking colleges? Why aren't you doing this? Why don't you do that? You know, I'm like, I don't know how to do any of this stuff. It's like, I don't know nothing about the system. He's like, you're an HR guy. I said, yeah, but I was only an HR guy for 2 years. I never did promotions. I don't know how any of this works. I did awards and evaluations. And so I had only done an aspect of my job. And so he showed me, he sat me down, he showed me, he said, you need to do this, this, and this. And I ended up, you know, doing very well. And when I left there, I ended up having gotten enough points to get promoted. What was interesting about that place was when I went over there, it was May of 2000. And so I came back and September 11th had occurred while I was there. So I was in the middle of the Sinai Peninsula in Arab country when the Twin Towers fell. That was a shock coming back. That's when kind of service and purpose of to country, my commitment really was important to me after that. It took on a whole new role. And, you know, when somebody says, hey, you know, are you going to continue to serve? I was like, yep. There was no thinking twice about it. So, going from, and I probably, so the towers fell about September 2011, and I came back about May, I'm sorry, I said 2011, 2001. I came back in May 2002. So I got over there in, May of 2001. And came back in May of 2002. So
when you were over in Egypt, I imagine at some point you might have had a bit of time off, and did you go and explore mm-hmm. like the pyramids complex and these sort of things that a lot of people want to see?
Yeah, so I explored the pyramids. I did the Nile River tours. How they measured the Nile River, the Nile meter, and stuff like that. I went to Cairo, the museums. Got to see a lot of amazing things. Cairo is a pretty cool place. I really began to enjoy my time over in Israel. I got to go to a lot, Masada, the Dead Sea, the Red Sea, and just do a bunch of cool stuff like that. See a little bit of history, the beginning of civilization over there, and just things that I would have never seen in my entire life. And I got the opportunity to see those. And that's kind of when I kind of reinvigorated that passion for history and understanding mm-hmm. some of these, more ancient civilizations and how they survived and, how they got water up the mountain here and, how they survived on Masada for, all that time. And that really became curious to me. I also found a passion for diving because once I found the Red Sea, I was like, that was one of the most beautiful places I'd seen. So I really began to snorkel and scuba dive down there. So
That's awesome. And I think one of the recurring themes that I sort of keep hearing coming up is mm-hmm. like mentor figures entering your life. Mm-hmm. And, were you looking for this, or was this a matter of like someone comes into your life and it fits the role and a relationship starts?
Yeah, no, it just, it's just men coming into your life and making deposits, right? I mean, that's all it was, is people just making deposits in the bank. They see someone in need and they just stop, like, oh, well, this guy looks a little bit lost or misguided. And the military was great for that, right? There's a lot of us that go in the military, they're not well off. The standards are pretty low these days, about who they let in, who they don't. Some people would consider it a social military welfare system nowadays. I would argue that those are some of America's brightest and best people. Just because they come from different circumstances doesn't make them any less of anything else. But the challenge with that, for me at least is that these people, I was kind of in that, I didn't know what to do next. So I would do nothing and people would see me, just, kind of stagnant, just kind of drifting. And they would pick up on that. That happened when I was in high school a couple times. I had a shop teacher and a wrestling coach that, made deposits in my life to kind of get me moving forward again. And honestly, most of these men, were good Christian, godly men. And I didn't even know it at the time. Reflecting back and having conversations with them later on, it was just that for them, it was their duty. One of the scriptures that is important to me that I talk about a lot is that, the Son of Man didn't come to be served. He came to serve. And so that's how I see a lot of these men. They came to serve others and not necessarily serve themselves. Because they didn't brag, they were like, hey, look what I did. I helped this guy out. It was just, they were doing a drive by, saw somebody in need, had a conversation, saw somebody that was down, they would just take the time out of their schedules to give something to someone else. So,
and there's something to be said for when we live for something that's bigger than ourselves, life feels mm-hmm. more meaningful. And, One of the concerns that maybe I have just kind of observing the direction society is going, maybe we always look at every generation looks at the next one coming up and goes, uh-oh, look what this one's getting into, But I really, especially with the rise of social media, I think of the rise of sort of self-centeredness in a way that maybe has never been there before, because it encourages us to put ourselves online for validation from other people and really become sort of self-absorbed. Yeah. you know. But, you know, so this has led you to a place where you feel like, hey, you know what? I grew up without a father. Yeah. There was kind of sort of this hole mm-hmm. in my life. You know, there's people that stepped in and filled that role mm-hmm. In one capacity or another for periods of time through my life. And so now I want to be able to give back as a result mm-hmm. of that, you know, and that's led you to what you're doing now.
Oh yeah. That's 100% true. I mean, that has become, you know, my purpose. You know, I would say, you know, a lot of these guys, you know, it was just by chance, you know, that they were there, you know, probably divine chance. Right. But, yeah. It's incredible to see how that happens. And most of the time, you know, guys like me who grew up in those circumstances, we don't know to look, we don't know to ask. Mm-hmm. We don't even know how to ask for help. You know, working with, you know, being in the Army for so long and having worked around so many people, that I knew that took their own life because they just didn't know ask for help. And even if they did, their cries mm-hmm. were unheard, because people didn't recognize the signs. You know, it is a challenge for a lot of us. It's so hard just to ask for help. And a lot of these boys, they just, and some men, they just don't know how to ask for help. I'm struggling, you know, I'm supposed to be, you know, the pastor, the provider, the protector, I'm supposed to be all these things. Right. And if I don't do those things, then society looks at me less of a man. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we all go through tough times, you know, we all have difficult moments, and we want to live up to those roles, but sometimes it's just really hard. Right. Because you're supposed to be a man. You're supposed to do it on your own. No, none of us do it on our own. I couldn't do it on my own. I had to have a strong, solid group of men around me, healthy, you know, godly, masculine figures that kind of lift mm-hmm. me up and kind of, you know, show me the way, you know, and help me out. That's what a father does for you. And, you know, it doesn't have to be necessarily a father, but it could just be a healthy father figure or a father-like figure that helps mm-hmm. you through. I mean, I knew men that I've had conversations with, you know, they were 30 and 40 years old, lost their father and felt lost. You know, lost their father to old age or something like that, you know, and it's like now there's this piece that's missing, right? We all going to go through it at some point in time. And so it's how do I, you know, you just got to reach out and ask for help.
You know, and I think you really touched on something very important there. Two aspects. One, not knowing even how to ask mm-hmm. for help, and others mm-hmm. around them not knowing to look for the signs of somebody who needs help. And the result of that is, because I believe the numbers are like male suicides are 3 times higher than female suicides, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's high. I mean, I could even tell you the statistics for fatherless, you know, and it's really crazy. There's like there's 25 million fatherless boy or children out there, right? 50% of America is growing up in a home without a father. There's 12 million boys. 72% of those boys become, 72% of adolescent murderers are fatherless. 60% of inmates in confinement facilities are fatherless. 85% of the kids in the juvenile detention homes are fatherless. And, you know, this is the one that always gets folks too. And it's probably, you know, more concerning because it's been recently in the news, but 75% of the mass shooters grew up without a father. And so when you look at it, the number one problem on society and probably our globe is kids growing up without a father. And it's really, really important that these kids have this father figure in their lives or else, you know, they become susceptible to those societal ills. And I tell folks, I got lucky because, you know, I could have been one of those people right then and there in those statistics. I mean, yeah, I was drinking, I was smoking, I was doing drugs, you know, all before the age of 14 years old. I just got lucky because I had a couple people that stepped in my life at the right time and kind of helped me course correct. And I was probably too ignorant to fight them, you know, and say, okay, well, they know what's best for me. And I don't know because, you know, I don't really have a pot to piss in today. And I just took their advice because that's the only advice I was given. And I appreciate that now looking back, you know, I'm like, okay, like those people really cared about me and they gave me some really good, solid advice. But when you're young, it's hard to listen. So,
yeah. Yeah. So, you know, fatherlessness is a huge, huge, huge problem, you know, mm-hmm. and there's just kind of a shifting in, I think in the way that society perceives, like maybe even the family unit in general, mm-hmm. do you, you know, is there any solution outside of, like, I'm curious, I guess, what sort of solutions are sort of being put forward, and if there are solutions outside of a father figure being in a child's life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a lot of great organizations out there. Like Fathers in the Field is one of them, that, you know, come alongside and, you know, help mentor fatherless boys. You know, for us not to have fatherless kids in America is probably, that's a tall order, right? To eliminate every, you know, to for every boy to have a father. I think that the possibility is there. Otherwise I wouldn't be a part of a program or trying to be a part of a program, but, I think the possibility is there, but it is a tall order and it probably won't happen in my lifetime. Now, you know, the solutions are, is to get these kids, you know, educated and have that healthy mentor father. That way we can break the cycle. Right. And it starts with the generation. So if you look at my grandfather's generation, it was probably about 28% of boys grew up without a father. That every generation since then, which is three or four generations ago, has increased almost by 10%, to where it's almost 50% now. And a lot of that is the destruction of the American home, you know, and, you know, it's easy to get divorced today. You know, the men are portrayed in a bad light at times, you know, as barbaric or toxic. And, you know, but we just have to do a better job of making sure that the right people are involved in the right kids' lives. And the right value system too. I think that's really important for me. That's why I'm a part of this program, right? Because I think you know, the engagements that these people have are really important. You know, two times a month we're attending church together. One time a month we're going through a journey guide and some curriculum. And then another part of that too is taking you out and participating in a hobby or an outdoor activity together. Something that I'm passionate about, that I love, and I'm sharing that with you. You know, my high school shop teacher shared his passion with me. My high school wrestling coach shared their passion. Those became my passions because they shared those with me. And so that was really important for me. And then a service project, right? And so, you know, that's why I like the Fathers in the Field, is because they do the service project as well. They go out and they help seniors and other members of the community, so that kid shows up and does this project alongside this mentor father, and they show that they have some value and worth. And I think those are just great staples, right, of a program, you know, that really help that child, you know, not only heal from their wounds, but also see the value that they have to offer the world, and not to find themselves in those situations with those statistics that I just read a little while ago.
Yeah. That's quite remarkable, really, just the ability to help them in that way. You know, if you were to just condense from your sort of life experience, and you've had a lot, you know, people listening to this conversation, if they were to take one kind of nugget away from this, what would you like to share with people?
Yeah, I think the one nugget I kind of mentioned earlier, you know, is ask for help. I mean, that's as simple as it gets. You know, I did not want to ever ask for help, and one of the things I learned here over the last couple of weeks, you know, working with some of these organizations too, I'm learning how to ask people for help. Saying, I need help. I need your help reaching the fatherless. I need your help, you know, doing this. I cannot do this by myself. And, you know, we need everybody. When I was doing some prevention training in sexual harassment and sexual assault arena while I was in the Army, that was the one thing that I would add at the end, is that, you know, these victims, they need your help. They can't do this alone. They need your support. And we all need someone. And so that was my nugget of wisdom to the victim advocates, is I was getting ready to train them for the next 6 weeks on how to do their jobs, is that victim, you might be the only person that one person has in their life. And, it's really important. And they may not know how to ask for help, you know, and so you have to learn how to understand what they need, you know, ask the right questions, you know, and guide them to the resources that they need to get back to where they need to be at, to have that healthy, productive life, and try to get back to some kind of normalcy after something really traumatic has happened. Because, you know, obviously that was important to me because it happened to my mother. And then also, you know, fatherlessness, because, you know, that's the my origin story as well. So,
yeah, yeah. You know, just teaching people to ask for help, I think that's so powerful. And then and making it okay, not only okay, but I think almost, you know, I really wish that we'd celebrate when people put up their hand and say, I need help. That would be, that would just be incredible to say that's,
yeah,
that's,
just raise your hand. I need help.
Just raise your hand and say, I need help. There's something admirable about reaching that place where we realize, okay, this doesn't make me lesser of a person when I reach out and ask for help. In fact, you know, we all learn from other people and we grow when we ask for help.
Yeah, you know, I mean, there's a guy I was working with in this internship company I was working with not so long ago. He would call people humans. And at first I kind of like, all right, I don't know how to take that, you know, but he would, you know, humans here, humans there, these humans over here. And I was like, okay, are you from outer space or something? Like you're calling us humans. And then he kind of took the human, if I felt at the beginning for me, it like it was taking humanity out of it. You know, working with, you know, in the Army and having seen so many people take their own life, and knowing those people and personally knowing them, you know, that's what, you know, and I had a good friend, his name was Joel Rodriguez, that when I was at Fort Riley, that first duty station, you know, he went, you know, and suffered for years and years and years from PTSD. And I just wish he would have called me up and said, hey, man, I need some help. Because I would have been there in a heartbeat. You know, so we've lost some really, really great people. And that's why I say, you know, everybody's valued. Everybody has value. Everybody has worth. And so it's, if you're struggling, you just got to ask for help.
Yeah. Well, Kirby, you know, I really, really appreciate you coming on tonight. And I appreciate just your willingness to share what is a really, really difficult story as well. And I think that willingness to share is what encourages other people to have the courage to step up and say, I need some help, and there's value even in sharing my story and taking the pain of my story and turning it into a sense of purpose. So I really just applaud you for doing that, and I appreciate you taking the time to be on here tonight.
Hey, thank you, John. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for tuning in to Between the Before and After. If you've enjoyed this episode, please like, share, subscribe, or leave a review, because that helps this podcast to reach and inspire more people. I love exploring the stories that take place between the before and after, the powerful experiences that shape who we become. And I love human potential. I love the possibilities that lie within us. So whatever you may be up against, I hope these stories inspire you. Because if you're still here, your story's not done yet, so keep moving forward.
Anyone can come from any place of brokenness and destitution and build an amazing life.